became wealthy, then there was somewhat of a caste system.
Right.
And how again, right. And it was an economy, it wasn't an economy before, there was a cashless society,
right.
Which is so rare. So that was just one example beautifully illustrated.
Yes, I love that passage, and I'll read
me
that.
Too.
So this is something I
thank
translated
you know
with
exactly
some help.
Where it is.
this is, I should give a little background. Mm-hmm. This is his writing about Mithila Village, Mithila. It's in the state of Bihar in northern mm-hmm. India. It's a very poor region of India even today. These people in Mithila Village lived for centuries very simply, with very little cash. And he wrote this for on the 20th anniversary of his first visit to Mithila. So this is much later, when he was an older man. And the main thing about Mithila for Itosan is that, and I love this, he said, I finally understood the meaning of the Indian villages. What is the meaning of living this way? So I'll read an excerpt. This is his writing, and it's called The Folk Paintings of Mithila Village. Walking around the village, I saw much had changed. I was sad to notice that the arbor where I had strung my mosquito net to sleep 2 decades ago had been replaced by a brick building. In fact, everywhere, newly built brick houses and tile roofs had been replacing traditional thatch, and I could see the increasing disparity between the rich and the poor. I bought many of the paintings that the village is known for to give to people at our upcoming conference, and this was written for a conference of folk art researchers in Japan, as well as to introduce other people in Japan to the beauty of their work. These are the same paintings I had come to see 20 years ago. In the more than 3,000-year history of these distinctive paintings, it is only recently that they have been painted on paper. Traditionally, they were painted on the walls of the house and were thought of as women's work, in the same way as cooking, cleaning, and doing the laundry was. And so girls would learn how to paint them as they grew up. These paintings were also always regarded as offerings to the gods, and it was not until recently that they were thought of as decorative or as, quote, art. About 35 years ago now, they started to paint on paper. This was also the time that the paintings started to be thought of as decorative, as a kind of adornment. As they became popularized and were turned into folk paintings for sale, the original spiritual nature of the art became more and more diluted. It seems to me that if the painting wasn't being made for a god, it could be drawn with a more carefree, easygoing feeling. That is to say, more lightly. And by the time of my visit, most villagers had completely given up painting on the walls in order to make commercialized versions on paper for sale. I also felt that the culture of the village had become more unmannerly and more rough and noisy, and the village itself seemed less well cared for. I wondered, had the influence exercised by cash income from the folk paintings begun? With the 3,000 years of history and tradition, the Mithila folk paintings were the communal property of all the people living in this region. And he's going to draw a metaphor here. I'm just going to interrupt for a second.
Sure.
With what's happening globally to all of us with our cultural property. So as I read this, you might want to think along those lines. Were the communal property of all the people living in this region. The villagers had a share in this fortune in their day-to-day life. When these paintings began to be painted on paper, this communal property became something that could be converted into cash. The paintings became material objects owned individually, and a big gap in income was born between people based on their talents as painters, or other things such as caste and class. Artists whose work was popular became rich, and they then became the target of jealousy from others. Long ago, the artistic vigor and talent was focused on the beautiful displays of artwork for festival days or at weddings, or as paintings for the gods themselves. But now this energy has all swung around toward the making of paintings as items for sale, and the quality of the original wall paintings has been neglected. I wonder if this is unavoidable in the ordinary course of things. And here's the key paragraph, and it's the end.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere in the world you can see this common property, our cultural heritage, being turned into money. And this is just one example of it. for the purposes of turning everything into economics, the nature and good culture of the whole earth, which are our common property, are being destroyed, and even the continuance of life itself is threatened. This is our era.
Yes, and I think about that so often myself, and it was so succinctly put. Mm-hmm. Everything seems to be privatized. It's happening now in the guise of debt.
And what's amazing is just, I even think here in Santa Cruz, how commodified everything becomes, even, you know, healing and, you know, sharing, all kinds of things. It's very discouraging sometimes.
And yeah. I feel like I am feeling like I'm being consumed. Where is the time to sit back and really listen to the crickets, as I used to when I was younger? I grew up on Cape Cod, to listen to the ocean waves. I have the ocean here, but I'm not thinking of it when I walk by. It was always very magical to me, the sound of the rushing waters, just enjoying the foam of the water. And there was all the little subtleties that I don't take the time to. And they seem also to be free, and just about everyone that you interviewed, in not being a part of the cash economy, not working for someone else, where their time was not their own.
Yeah,
Each one had their own
different ways. They all use some cash, I should say, but they've done as much as possible. Yeah, they've done as much as possible to provide for themselves, and I like that. The story of the ocean that you just spoke of, because why does that happen? We can buy books on, you know, seven ways to recycle better, or non-toxic cleansers, or studies of solar power versus, you know, wind or nuclear power, and that's important work. But that's why I thought that this book was something that really. Well, let me start. When I met these people, I thought I really should write a book about them, because I felt like there was sort of an inner sustainability, an inner fiber that allowed them, and I didn't know what it was that allowed them to not chase after the next, in my case, say the next email or the next blog post or the next appointment.
Distraction.
Yeah, and maybe it's something important to us in some ways, but then we're not listening to the ocean. So
we're not listening to that little quiet voice within.
Well, I have a question, because obviously Japan is an interesting culture, because you have the modern culture that's become so technological, and obviously we see the ultimate of that is the nuclear power meltdown and all of this, but people so addicted to their gadgets, just like here, and then this more grounded in the earth, deeper spiritual awareness. How did you experience that in Japan?
Their spiritual awareness?
Well, the contrast between those two things, the technological modernization. And
Certainly everybody that I profiled in the book has left the city. I have many friends who are in the city and who are living very interesting lives as artists or activists in the city and making space inside of the city for themselves. I think this might be a good time to introduce another person. She's the woman I interviewed in Chapter 5. Her name is Asha Amemiya, and I started with a really provocative quote at the beginning of the chapter. She says, "If you don't have a lot of unsatisfied people, the system just stops dead." And I said, what do you mean by that? She said, "Well, you know, the new computer comes out, and it's great, and you buy it, and you think, well, then you get it, right? But then the next one is even better, and it really is even better, you know, and it's the iPad, she didn't say that, but, you know, it's got all these new functions, it's lighter, it's faster, the old one isn't working as well, and you just keep chasing after it, and you're only satisfied for a little bit, but as long as you stay unsatisfied and you keep chasing after that, there's no end to it, she says, there's just, you just keep going after it." So the way the way she looked at me and she said, you know, just enough. It's like when my stomach is full, it's enough. I'm through. And so that's one of the ways she has dealt with it. I think
she has certain questions that she lived by. Will it harm someone? What I do, what I say? Is it close to me? Is it real? Is it authentic? And there was a third.
Does it involve using money?
Yes.
Does it involve using money?
And so she had certain guidelines.
I mean, you know, Japan really is, I mean, when I first...
She said they're unusual, the individuals. They are. I don't think they're representative of most Japanese today or modern Japanese.
They are very, very unusual in a lot of ways, but I also think there's something that is very Japanese about them that you would find in everyday mainstream Japan. I think there's a certain self-discipline, a lot of self-discipline, a lot of real concern for other people that you'll find, you know, in everyday delivery people and bus drivers and salespeople, that really the concern is directed outwards, and I think that really helps. And I think in mainstream you'll find, even in some of the denser areas of Tokyo, people growing their own rice, a lot of people grow their own food. It's not so far away. And I think this is something that I wanted to bring back to the United States because, well, in my case, my grandfather and grandmother used cash to get everything they needed. Mm-hmm. My great-grandparents used cash to get everything they needed. But up until after the war, at least in the mountains, you know, up until maybe even the mid-50s, the great majority of people in the mountains of Japan used very little cash. They did what they needed. So this is a book, strangely to say, about economics. Economics of how do you provide for what you need and how do you decide what it is you need.
So timely now, too.
So they use barter? Or
There's a fair amount of barter. There's a lot of making your own baskets, for example, gathering your own wood, and just using them.
And up next, it's Bathrop's Piers Broadsides, the April 21st, 2011 edition, with hopefully a call-in from co-founder of Food Not Bombs, Keith McHenry. Stay tuned.
I like Mrs. Bridges. I go to Mrs. Bridges. I eat at Mrs. Bridges on a Friday for breakfast. There are only 7 tables, flowers on the tables, and smokers at the tables on a Friday. Now you may think I'm joking, but some smokers when they're smoking don't notice if you're choking or you're dying. There's this one fella, Andy, a real chain smoker, and he blows smoke right at me till I'm crying. I asked him quite politely, in fact I asked him nicely, would you mind not smoking on a Friday? Don't like it when I'm eating, don't like it when I'm breathing, don't like it anywhere or any day. He told me it's a habit, I choose to have it, and you choose to come here on a Friday. So you're the problem, not me, and if I choose to rot me, you've got no right to stop me, cause it's my way. Cause it's a free world, democracy and all that, it's a free world, laissez-faire and all that, and if industry can do it, so can I. The smokers cheered him loudly, he lit another proudly. As for me, I looked around me for a friend. I thought of world pollution, I thought of evolution, I thought of revolution, but I paid my bill and left. I thought of Mother Jones, I thought of Rosa Parks, Sojourner Truth and Rosa Luxemburg, it's them I have to thank. Guerrilla folks have taught me a freedom you are wanting. If head-on fights are daunting, use the flank. So, I ate corn on Sunday, I ate beans on Monday, on Tuesday leeks and lentils made a high day. I tell you I'm not joking, by Thursday I was floating, but I'm ready for the smoking on a Friday. I sat down next to Andy. I smiled at Andy. He lit up. I let off a beauty. I sat and read the paper and chatted with the waiter and let my compost maker do its duty. Beans are for pitching, leeks are malediction, sweet corn is for density and lentils for duration. The recipe's been tested, it hasn't yet been bested. Add cabbage for perfume and concentration. Andy, he turns yellow, the atmosphere is mellow, the percussion section's way over the top. It soon put Andy's fag out. Andy hung the flag out. Andy choked and swore and muttered, "Stop." I told him it's a habit. I choose to have it. And you choose to come here on a Friday. And if you don't like it, I guess you'll have to hike it. Cause I'll fight for farters' rights until I die. Cause it's a free world, liberty and all that. It's a free world, selfishness and all that. And if Andy can do it, so can I. He changed his day to Thursday. I changed my day to Thursday. He changed his day to Wednesday. So did I. The waitress, she was cheering. Her bronchitis, it was clearing. And she was volunteering for the Tuesday. Mrs. Bridges, I go to Mrs. Bridges. I breathe at Mrs. Bridges on a Friday for breakfast. There are only 7 tables, flowers on the tables, and no smokers at the tables any day. Cause it's a free world, strategy and all that. It's a free world, crude comedy and all that. But if I can do it, so can anybody.
And you are tuned to the stream of freakradio.org or freeradio.org at freakradio.org. This is and would be 101.1 FM, but no, we're not out there. We're still hoping to get out there. Pretty sure. No, we ain't there yet. But, you know, I cannot give regular listeners any real clear hopes as to how this can be done. If you want to offer assistance, encouragement, denunciations, you can call the voicemail at 427-4523, area code 831-427-4523. What you just heard was It's a Free World, part of Peggy Seeger's An Odd Collection, and I'm kind of pleased by these songs. They're from many years ago, or a number of years ago anyway, 1996. I think this was shortly after Ewan McCall died, her partner of many years, and she now has another partner, I believe a female partner, and it's she's been doing new stuff. This is Peggy Seeger, Pete Seeger's half-sister, who is, I think, frankly, far more interesting, political and topical than Pete Seeger, but that's just more a matter of preference, I guess, than anything else. So, welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides. That's this twice-weekly show where we cover homeless civil rights issues and whatever else fits into my brain and onto the air, or at least in this case onto the stream. The call-in number for those who want to call in, and we are broadcasting live, if you're listening to this on your stream, at 427-3772 is the call-in number, 831-427-3772, 831-427-3772. You can give a call in. I am, however, expecting a call from Keith McHenry, who is driving to Colorado for some kind of a shindig at Fort Collins. McHenry is the co-founder of the organization Food Not Bombs, which has been experiencing some problems lately in Orlando, Florida. Of course, it usually is sort of up against the up against the wall in one city or another, but also successfully providing often recycled vegan food to people throughout the world. According to the Food Not Bombs website, there are more than 400 Food Not Bombs throughout the world, half of them outside the United States. And I'm looking at the Food Not Bombs new page at foodnotbombs.net, and there's a whole series of interesting new struggles that they talk about. Food Not Bombs is an organization that I'm particularly concerned with, was involved with a lot about a decade ago, well, actually 15, 16 years ago, more than that even, in San Francisco and in Santa Cruz, when they not only feed poor people and make poverty visible, but they stand up for the rights of homeless people, and that's particularly important. They actually enable and encourage homeless people to assemble in public spaces, as they have a right to do, but as middle-class property owners, some of them, and the police departments of this city, that city, and the next city don't want them to do. So there were protests long, well, there were encampments in front of City Hall in San Francisco, and Food Not Bombs tends to show up at events such as the what was called Fort Agnos, or Camp Agnos, actually, after the mayor, Art Agnos, they support the rights of homeless people and the demands that there be a fundamental change in the priorities of this country, to wit, food, not bombs. And, of course, we have the opposite. We have bombs, not food, as the major preoccupation of the national government and, frankly, of the local government, which spends, I think it's about half its budget on the police department, parks and rec, and security agencies in order to keep the poor in hand and make sure that, you know, you don't jaywalk or sleep outside after 11 o'clock at night or sit too close to a building, you know, smoke in the wrong place. The last song, It's a Free World by Peggy Seeger, notwithstanding. I have a lot of sympathy because I'm not much of a smoker. The occasional joint, perhaps, but not tobacco at all, and not a lot of marijuana. So I don't much like smoke in the areas where I am, but I realize that that really should be a matter of the understandings between the people who are there, not some kind of flatfoot who comes stalking in because somebody's smoking a cigarette when nobody else is around, and there's a little rule up there. And I have this problem with rules, let's say this concern with rules that have nothing to do with real information or real safety and health concerns or real needs in the situation, which has often put me at odds with a lot of other people, even those who I agree with on a number of issues. So, for instance, at the Sub Rosa Cafe the other day, where Huff holds its weekly meeting, when we can get in, because half the time they've been closed, and, you know, there have been numerous problems, but they've tried to accommodate us to some extent. It's a small room inside the cafe. They have, I think I've talked about this issue on the air before. They had a policy of not allowing audio recording inside the cafe or on the cafe property at one time. And you might say, well, you know, this is to protect the privacy of the people there. But it really wasn't in the cases where I was recording, because I was interviewing people at their request, and there were other people around who wanted to hear the recording, wanted to hear the interview as we spoke. So it really was an attempt to enforce an arbitrary rule against people who were all voluntarily interested in what was going on in an educational process. And rules tend to put people in positions of authority on a collision course with those they choose to want to control. They seem to feel they have an obligation to control them because they want to, quote, enforce the rules, even though the rules don't necessarily bear on the needs of the community that's there at the moment. And I had a similar situation that came up yesterday when a guy came into the Huff meeting, wanted, Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. It's our weekly civil rights group there. And he wanted to tell about his encounter with the police and how upset he was, and Normally, I asked everybody in the group if they minded if he told his story and if I recorded it so I could play it on the air, and I will, whether today or another day is not clear because, again, I'm still hoping to get a call from Keith McHenry and do some play some of that and actually get some live interview there talking about the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals ruling against Food Not Bombs' right to free speech and distribution of food in Orlando, Florida. It's a pretty serious situation going on there. But at this guy, anyway, he spoke to us, not very long, 5 or 10 minutes. And apparently the guy who was managing the Sub Rosa, Wes Modes, who is, I'm a fan of, and in many cases he's a fan of mine. So it was a principled, although somewhat spirited, difference between us. He apparently wanted me not to record without asking permission. And the significance is that when I do tape recordings, it's a very limited kind of thing. You can really only hear the person who is close to the microphone. Everybody in the area is aware I'm doing it. And it's, I guess if somebody's trying to concentrate on something else, that would be something. But the fact is the volume of our meeting was just as loud as anything we were doing on the tape recording, probably a little less. The recording was quieter, the conversation I had with the person I wanted to interview who had been complained about a police incident. And after it was over, I was told that I should have requested the permission of the management before I recorded. And I said, well, no, I don't really think that's appropriate. I think, first I asked, has anyone objected to this recording? Did anybody feel uncomfortable? Nobody said they had. And I guess Wes made the point, that he was the manager in that situation, that, well, you didn't know that before you started. And I guess my thought was if anybody had been uncomfortable, they could have spoken to the management and said, you know, I'm uncomfortable with this. And they could have made that clear. Although nobody was uncomfortable at all, it was a purely theoretical proposition. And it was an attempt to essentially say, you will follow these rules because we run this place and we can kick you out if you don't. And I said, that's an example of the assertion of power over what is a reasonable situation. And it was a significant dispute we had, I thought. And I told him my general inclination was not to pay a lot of attention to posted rules unless they made sense in a particular situation, as far as I was concerned, and particularly this rule. So I'm still kind of chewing it over and thinking about it. And it's an interesting point because the Sub Rosa Cafe is, for many people, quite a resource. And for me, too. I've been there over the years, used it for meeting space, met people there, encouraged people to go there for the relatively cheap coffee, a dollar. They throw community events. They make available a very unique anarchist library that you can't find elsewhere, which you can borrow without a lot of bureaucratic bullshit. And I think they're a great community resource. So the fact that I have severe and strong differences on some points doesn't take away from my admiration for their work there. But anyway, that issue did come up, and it's come up in the past, mostly because I think people in positions of authority tend to misuse their authority in the enforcement of these rules, whether they're police officers on the street, people running bourgeois establishments, or people who are representing a collective in an anarchist cafe. I mean, the real issue, I think, at any time is whether there is a problem on the premises, not whether people are following the rules. And I think that's really the basic issue. The fact that people are not following rules is not a problem unless there is some real problem in addition to that. And ironically, that's the same issue that's coming up at City Council when I go in there on Tuesday again to review with the City Council, I should say, to present to the City Council sort of Chapter 2 of my suggestion that they drop their fighting against the lawsuit that they've been facing for 9 years and change their what are called decorum and City Council rules that have essentially criminalized people at the whim of the chair. The chair, in a way, it's much worse than the Sub Rosa. The chair can make up rules as they go, or they can ascribe to people's behavior a disruptive intention and say, you're being disruptive, you have to leave or you'll be arrested, even if nothing has stopped the meeting except the chair of the meeting, the mayor usually, who doesn't like something somebody in the audience is doing, maybe holding up a sign, maybe an outburst of "I disagree," "No," "Ridiculous," maybe some or hissing. These are things that are natural expressions of the democratic sentiment at one point or another, and they're something that city councils, as representatives of the community, of legislative bodies, should have to listen to and endure. That's part of their job, not suppress. And that is the issue, actually, for which I went to court way back in 2002 when I was arrested for not leaving the council after I'd made a mock Nazi salute. Very silent, very, very quick. It wasn't very silent. It was simply silent. I didn't say anything. I just raised my arm from the side of the room, indicating that I thought the mayor was acting like a fascist and how he was treating other people at the mic. This was used as the pretext by another council member to stop the meeting, denounce me, demand I be removed from the room, and then recess the meeting and have me led out of the room in handcuffs, for which I sued them. They never actually brought their charges against me to court because there was no disruption other than the one they created. But now I want to make sure that this doesn't happen to other people. And so what I want to make sure it happens is that before anyone is evicted from the chamber for violating a rule, that there is an actual disruption happening, not just a violation of a rule. Disruption, you know, is a more sensitive thing in a city council proceeding than, let's say, in a more public space, in a more free public space, like in a public sidewalk or in a park or even in a cafe, I would say, because there is a strict agenda that the city council is adhering to, and you can't, for example, talk about things that aren't on the agenda, although some disagree with me on that subject, interestingly enough. I just got an email today on that. But you're supposed to stick to the topics at hand because the point is to get some business done, and usually, unfortunately, it's not our business. It's the business of the police department or the business of developers or, you know, the business of favored city council clients and things of that sort. But in any case, the issue will be coming up before the City Council on Tuesday. That's one of the things I'll be talking about more on Sunday, although I've kind of talked about the issue. I am soliciting people who have had bad experiences at the Santa Cruz City Council to either email me or give me a call to let me know what changes in the City Council rules that they would like to see. I'm proposing various changes myself, which I've already discussed in prior shows, and we'll talk again about on Sunday. But let's set all that aside for the moment. First of all, let me give you my number so you can call. The number for those who want to suggest rule changes or problems they've had at City Council is 423-4833, area code 831-423-4833. Give me a call. Let me know what your experience is and what your suggestions are. Or you can email me at rnorse3@hotmail.com, rnorse3@hotmail.com, and we will take it from there. So I see that I had thought that Keith McHenry would be calling in, and it looks like he is not yet doing that. So I will review something that I actually played last Sunday when I had a previous and longer show segment. This is an interview with some folks downtown on the street. I think we're talking April 12th. It's about a week ago, a little more than a week ago. And it's just a quick interview with three youths, one of whom claims he was punched by a police officer. And a quick correction. And actually, before we get to that particular point, I think actually we are at that particular point, so we may be doing well.
talking with.
Kenny White.
And what happened to you, sir?
They harassed me.
And when did this happen?
Yesterday.
And what exactly happened?
They punched me in the mouth.
And who was the officer involved?
I'm not sure what his name was.
Officer James Daniel of the Santa Cruz Police Department.
What was his name?
Officer James Daniel of the Santa Cruz Police Department.
Were you a witness or did you just...
I was a witness.
And where did this happen?
Right over there.
You're pointing across the street.
Coldstone.
In front of the Ohm Gallery? Or?
By Coldstone.
Say that one more time.
Coldstone.
Coldstone Creamery?
Yes, yes.
And what was the circumstance where this happened?
He thought he was smoking weed and he wanted to give it to him, so the officer punched him in the face.
Yeah. Is that what happened?
Yeah, he hit me with his elbow and dropped me to the ground and put me in cuffs.
And were you ultimately charged with anything?
No. He found out that I didn't have anything on me. He searched me, and then he left.
How old are you?
15.
And have you told your guardian or parent about this shit?
Yes.
What was their reaction?
I don't really remember.
Were they concerned? Or?
Yeah, they were pretty upset about it, and they tried to call the police, but they didn't believe us.
Yeah, the police didn't really care.
Yeah, they did not.
Were you a witness as well?
I was also a witness.
What's your name?
Morgan.
Full name is?
Morgan Grable. Morgan Grable.
Oh, what middle name?
And your name is?
It's James Connor.
Because, you know, you can file a complaint, not that it'll do a hell of a lot of good, but at least it'll go on the record of the police officer. What the name of the officer again was?
James something. It was James. He had the same name as me. James Daniel, was it?
Yeah.
And was there another officer or just one officer involved?
Another officer came later on, but there was only one officer at the time.
And what were you three together at the time?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah. Well, we were inside the pizza, Joe's Pizza, and he was walking by himself.
You were walking by yourself?
Yes.
And how did you just visually saw it from the window?
No, like when we were walking out, we saw it. And they were like yelling at him, like, what's going on?
And about what time did you come upon this? What was happening?
6:53 p.m.
And what time did... 6:53 p.m., not p.m.?
Yeah.
And you were saying it was in the afternoon.
Late afternoon.
Late afternoon.
Yeah.
And so what did you see as you arrived? What exactly did you see?
The officer just threw him on the ground and punched him in the face when he was trying to search his pockets.
And how close were you to the incident?
About 20 feet.
And how close were you?
A good 20 feet. I was with him.
And what did you see?
The same exact thing. He was on the ground, got punched in the face.
And did this happen after you arrived, as you were walking up?
We were walking to meet him.
Right.
Yeah.
And
we stopped when we saw the police officer with him because we didn't want to go up there.
And did you hear anything before the blow that you say that you saw?
Nothing.
Did you hear any dialogue after that?
No. The police officer was like yelling, not yelling, but like very extremely stern.
And what was he saying?
He was just like, well, you don't resist me, blah, 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 just like going off on him. But he wasn't even doing anything. He had nothing on him. They didn't find anything on him. They let him off free.
Now, do you remember what was said to you by the police officer, if anything?
He said, get the fuck on the ground. then...
You got punched super hard.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I don't have a black eye yet.
Where were you punched?
Right here, in my left eye.
Right there.
He's trying to probably get back. And then, so he said, get the fuck on the ground. Then he tripped me onto the ground, and I tried to get back up. He elbowed me in the face. I dropped to the ground. He put the cuffs on. He's like, don't resist me. And I was like, I don't have anything. He's like, don't talk. And then he yelled at me, and then he put cuffs on me, and he searched me, and he had nothing on me. He took off handcuffs and walked away.
Did he say anything, apologize?
No, he just walked away.
How long did all this take, would you estimate?
5 minutes.
Yeah, about 5 minutes.
Did you get any kind of medical treatment afterward?
No, I went to the emergency room. They just looked at my face, made sure nothing was broken.
Did you get an ambulance? Did you get a ride?
I got a ride from him. He drove me.
Do you remember the name of the doctor or anybody was there treating you?
No.
Did you get any paperwork there?
No.
Good idea to do that in the future, by the way, so you get evidence of what happened. And also, well, this will be played on free radio probably on Sunday morning. I'll give you my card. You can see the times. If you want, give me your phone numbers and our email addresses and names, and I'll pass it on to a police it's an anti-abuse group that talks about stopping police misconduct downtown.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a cell phone or computer, so I don't have any way to contact me.
Any way of contacting you guys?
Oh yeah, I'll give you my email.
Okay. And we'll do that again. We've been talking with David.
Andrews.
Full name?
Andrews.
David.
Crack. Oh, Morgan Grable.
I'll see
James Connors.
Thank you all.
Yep.
Here we are.
Attending the church inside.
So, Paul, you got a ticket for parking in front of the Greek Orthodox Church on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And you got a ticket, your name, sir?
Scott.
For
camping.
In the
Poconips.
And how did that do? Was it a ranger or a police officer?
Actually, first we were warned by the rangers that we weren't allowed to try and, you know, live some semblance of a life out there.
Sleeping is not allowed at night. Now, you can sleep during the day. That is legal. Why don't you try to do that?
Because
you can walk around at night and sleep during the day. Kind of a vampiric existence.
Yeah, I like the sun, one.
Oh, come. The sun is not for you, my boy.
I like some human contact, too.
Human contact is good, but, you know, it costs money. Get some money, you'll get some human contact. Go ahead.
Not necessarily, but that's okay.
Go ahead.
For all your listeners who are cute and female and want to take me home, I'm up for adoption, but...
He's pretty good looking, too, folks. So. A little bit hairy, a little bit grubby, but still...
I shave so I don't look like Mick Foley anymore, but they came and warned us that we couldn't, you know... That we need to be on, you know, artificial stimulants, find something to do between 11 p.m. and 8 a.m.
Get back to your ticket. What time did you get your citation?
Oh, gosh, it was like 10:30.
And what were the two of you together?
We were camping
were
in the same
room. Yeah.
Yes, I
no
was.
No wonder they gave you a ticket.
Oh,
and how many others were involved in this?
Me, him, and another friend of ours, who, by the way, is a Iraqi war veteran.
This is at 10:30 at night?
Morning.
In the morning.
During the scattered showers that pervade over Monday.
I have to hold this while I put on these glasses to see if actually what this ticket says. Because normally, it's only illegal to sleep at night between the hours of 11 p.m. and 8:30 a.m.
Yeah.
So let's double check.
We had
criminals not only were sleeping, but they were also tenting. I'm going to call
raining.
A cop over here to get you arrested if you don't mind.
But it was raining.
It was raining.
Yes,
oh, you're such a baby. Why don't you sleep outside?
Yes,
I mean, get a little rain. It's good for you.
The cop also told me that if he came back up there and I had any problems with any of the rangers who tried to give anybody problems, he said he would come up there and make up something to take me to jail.
Which officer was this creative artist?
What's his name?
Inua?
Enway told me.
Enway, I know.
Told me he'd come back up and make a reason to take me to jail if I gave anybody any problems. And I haven't been to jail in 3 years here, and I'm not trying to go back. And when I went there,
so lodge. He wants to give you some better accommodations.
Oh no, that's not better accommodations.
No,
I was living indoor here for 2 years, and I'm trying to get back into indoor accommodations. And it's not really easy, but I'm doing it. I'm doing my best, and I'm gonna keep working with HPHP and them. And see if I can find some indoor housing.
And again, we're talking with
Randolph Baden Tully III. Everybody in this town calls me Dread Eye. I've been called Dread Eye for the last 20 years.
Even though your eyes don't look too dreadful to me.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yes. So you both got a ticket for let me see this ticket at camping because your tent was up there full blown and
yep
out. It was raining. You said
it was raining a half hour before they got there. It was raining a half hour before they arrived.
No, Monday this
morning. All right, well, it looks like they pulled a fast one on you. This is not a camping ticket.
Ew.
This is being in a forbidden closed area. So the Poganip supposedly was closed at 10:30 in the morning? That doesn't sound very likely.
No, we're in an area they consider a closed area on the hill because it used to be Heroin Hill. Me and Scott don't do that. We puff a little pot, maybe drink a beer once in a blue moon. But, No, that hill used to be always called Heroin Hill because the people that used to be there used to do a lot of, you know, meth and
cocaine.
Does it
have a sign that says closed, posted?
No, it has no sign saying closed or posted.
You want to go to a picture of the hill? And, you know,
I can do that. I have a very nice camera. I have two cameras.
That works. Then this says open container. Well... You know, unless you
are... I'm trying to relax in the woods, you know, and I'm...
I don't want to hear any excuses. Yeah. You're a drunk. I can see that right now. The alcohol is reeking off of you. I'm about to collapse. I don't know what to
tonight. You've got to be kidding me.
No, actually, you smell... I don't smell anything, actually. You might try some kind of a fragrance. I could smell something. It's kind of, you know, boring.
Okay.
All right, so I would encourage you to come to a Huff meeting or... Huff meetings at 10:30 on Wednesday mornings at the Sub Rosa. Or you can go to Steve Plaich's, I'm told. Yes, 10:30.
We can make that.
The other thing is, even before that, on Monday, you know when the Red Church
is? Hang out with him all the
Scott,
time.
You know the Red Church with the Monday meal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Go there and look for Steve Plaich. He says I got a legal assistance project.
Okay.
You know, and...
That's a Calvary Episcopal Church across from the Farmer's Market, Jack's Hamburgers, and the Nickelodeon. And it's between 5 and 6 or 6:30 that Steve Plaich hangs out there. He's had a significant legal background. He's been helping the Peace Camp 2010 protesters prepare their case for trial. which begins next Monday for all of you court watchers who want to come to court and support some really brave and strong and much harassed activists who have been fighting to end the sleeping ban and now have been forced into court and face many, many months in jail. But if you want legal assistance on your own projects, your own tickets, Steve Plaich may well be a good resource. You'll have to talk to him about it. He may or may not be able to help you, but he can be found at the Red Church on Monday evenings, 5 or 6 o'clock, right there at the meal, and check him out. Continuing with this interview from April 12th, more than a week ago.
How come we have so many police cars? Why don't you go get some crime, guys?
Sorry, I need to head express myself.
No, can you keep them on their toes?
Yeah, got to keep them going, right. Don't need to keep observing me.
You know,
I mean, I'm not that attractive.
Come over here and harass us.
Right. So,
yeah, but try to eat food and live.
So you've gotten a little food here from Paul here. Now, so, again, my suggestion to anybody, to anyone listening, I should take my bag, though.
Yes, is
between 5 and 6 in the Red Church on Monday, look for Steve Plaich.
Okay.
He's a tall guy. He's got kind of grayish hair.
Okay.
And ask anybody where Steve is, Steve Plaich. He's doing the Legal Assistance Project for the homeless.
That sounds good.
I'm not sure what it actually involves. It's just begun. And then if that doesn't work, come to the Huff meeting, and we'll just give you a cup of coffee and say, tough shit. But we'll also try to help with the ticket.
Yeah, I need to get online, too, with Scott and get a new power cord for my computer. I have a computer, and I have another computer built. And
I wish you luck with that.
Thank you.
Again, we've been talking with...
Put me on your show.
You're going to go on the show on Sunday morning, right now.
You always have me on your recorder. Actually, you had me in the studio.
Well, if you want to be on the show, we'll put you on the show. Well, in fact, we will highlight you as a typical example of the failed homeless programs of Santa Cruz.
Yeah, that's me, too.
Actually,
we need to come up with some more housing. For people who've been here like me for like 7-8 years now on the streets, and well, I was off streets for a couple years, but they need to make more housing that's more available for people in my situation. I mean, the amount of low-income housing they have here, I mean, is ridiculously bad for us. I mean, I guess for some of the Mexicans it's a little better, but for the minority now, which is the white man, we're getting nothing. There's no housing out here for the poor white man.
Oh, so you're one of these half breeds, eh?
Yeah, I am.
And we got a half. You hang out with a Mexican here? What's going
on
here?
Well, he's half of the
Jamaican Canadian.
I think it's just shocking. Yeah. I don't know what to say. You know, I mean,
half of you is the minority.
Probably speak Spanish or something.
Half of you is the
minority.
No,
the Canadian part of
the white part of you.
Anyway,
Canadian part of me.
We'll leave this discussion. We've been talking with
Shipping Canadian
Scott and
Red Eye.
Thank you both.
Kenneth Minahan.
And you said you had a brief encounter with an officer of the law?
That told me I couldn't make a woman smile. It was sexual harassment.
And what was your behavior that we were attempting to tease?
I told her she was a goddess. And she smiled.
And the officer, who was the officer? Didn't
I don't know his name, but he was very small, obviously, wasn't he?
What did he? And was he making a joke or was he making serious comments?
No, he was serious. In fact, I'm heading back down there to go back to prison for making a woman smile, because I will stand up for our rights, Robert.
Did you get a ticket or no?
Not yet, but I'm fixing to.
Well, I hope that a number of women smile for you.
Always. Always, Robert. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And may you always be out here to help us.
Well, at least to record what's going on.
That's
some of
right.
It, anyway.
That's what help is.
Well, again, we've been talking with
Kenneth Minahan.
Thank you, Kenneth.
The one and only.
All right, man.
I love you, Robert.
Switch to slow speed.
The owner. Come on over.
I think I recognize this guy.
Yeah, this guy's a good guy.
You gotta watch out for this guy.
Yeah?
He'll flip the script on you.
No, I'll just demand you give me some stats.
Yeah?
So we're talking with
John
and
Ian.
And this is at the Creme de Canna Pavilion here at the Earth Day Fair on April 16th. Boy, it's a beautiful day. A lot of booths up here. And I know that you're one of, 16 or 20 distribution centers in the county currently? Is that accurate?
I have no idea.
No?
Yeah, I have no idea.
How is it going with the county's regulations? I know I've seen recently they've got some proposed stuff that's going to be finalized, in early May?
Yeah, you know, I missed that meeting. It was supposed to be postponed, and then they had it, so I really have no idea
Because somebody, and I thought Creme de Canada was mentioned, was concerned that it would impact your organization specifically because of the restrictions around, you know, being near a school or near a, which I've always regarded, frankly, as kind of bogus, because I think they don't have such restrictions for pharmacies. You know, why would they have them for medical marijuana distribution places?
Yeah, I think that verbiage is still in the legislation, but there's a period of 12 months that we'll have to get an appeal or to find a more suitable location, you know, if they do indeed make us relocate. So, you know, we're just trying to be proactive and respectful. We're out here, you know, at the Earth Day event, trying to create awareness for our community and in hopes of, you know, creating a positive change as to the general understanding about, you know, medical marijuana. And, you know, hopefully when it comes up on May, you know, maybe, you know, by us being out here and getting people to talk about it and think that, you know, we're not just some illicit thing, you know, that people are scared of, you know, but we're a part of the community, we're contributing to the community, we're, you know, donating time and energy to clean the beaches and to educate people. We have vitamins and all sorts of health food products that we're starting to carry at cost to help promote health and well-being within our organization. And, you know, we're just really excited to continue to create awareness and positivity.
Let me ask you about this, though. That there is a provision in the county law that suggests now they're going to, if not require, recommend, encourage, sounds like require, free access to marijuana for poor people. Is that, do you have any understanding of where that's gone or what stage that's at? Because that's really the issue for a lot of us.
I think that's a specific quote.
I'm sure it's not. I'm just verbiage
a little bit mistaken, and I'm not specifically. I don't know that one off the top of my head either. So, you know, it's interesting to see how all of that unfolds. You know, and you know, we'll do our best to, you know, continue to help, to be generous with the community, and, you know, to be an active part of everything positive that's happening in regards to medical marijuana in Santa Cruz.
You had something to say about that too, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, regardless of whether they're making it a law or not, we're already doing it. So
What is Creme de Canada doing to assist people who don't have the money? Because it's pretty expensive for poor people to get marijuana.
Well, a lot of our patients are pretty upfront with us. They're more than happy to tell us they're broke and that they need assistance. And so we're working at achieving that right now. In fact, we're working at something even bigger, which is, you know, growing bioorganically, so that what's coming to people, there's nothing nothing that can hurt them from it. You know, it's the process is 100% bioorganic. It's like a super organic, you could call it.
Right. Well, I mean, I think I'm glad to hear that. The question is, can they get access to it at all if they're poor, is my problem. I mean, for those people I know who have a lot of, particularly poor people who are outside, who are homeless, have a lot of physical problems, some of which could be really helped with marijuana. And you got to pay what? Huge amount of money for a recommendation, well, over $100, then more money for a card, then you have to go buy from, you know, organizations that usually are supplying to middle-class people who have more means, so...
Yeah, well, we have stuff on our shelves at $5 a gram. There's no one else doing anything like that. We're actually in the process of lowering all our top shelf prices just to accommodate the public's need to access the best medicine at the most affordable prices. Mm-hmm. So we're the community.
And I want to interrupt this because I had one of these two guys on the air in the studio as a guest. Some of you may remember a month or two ago. We're talking about the Creme de Cannabis marijuana distribution group. Our cannabis provider, marijuana provider, they're in the county. I'm not sure where in the county they are. And they, I think it was John who was in the studio with me. I don't know his last name at the moment. But one of the key questions that came up was the issue of profiteering, how much money came in and how much money went out. I think Bob LaMonica called in and asked that question, and John said he didn't know, but he would find out and get back to us. And, well, by cracky, in spite of repeated emails and phone calls, he never got back to us. And here he is again, and you can hear him and his friend Ian, who, frankly, I think was a bit more candid, touting the virtues of their organization, you know, and I'm not saying that they aren't accurate necessarily and that their organization doesn't have virtues. I did not ask this question until actually later in the day because... actually, my mind had been blown by too much cannabis. Actually, that wouldn't be the case. It was actually, I get involved in so many issues on the air that it sometimes takes me a while to catch up with them. And I don't know, age and, I don't know, the city council's secret poisoning of my food, probably. Just kidding, folks, is catching up with me. But in any case, I'm skeptical of what sounds like a lot of hype is perhaps a little strong, perhaps not. But I'm concerned, you know, there is a real issue that, you know, a difference between those involved in small medical marijuana collectives or who are trying to get medical marijuana and a couple of activists who've come on our show, Anita Henry for one, Craig Canada for another, who has his own show on Sunday evening at 6 o'clock, specifically about medical marijuana, 6 o'clock on Sunday night, are concerned about profiteering by the dispensaries. And the issue of profiteering is one that also is used by right-wingers who say that, you know, this is all just a big racket, big drug lords making money. It has nothing to do with medical problems. And it's, you know, it's ruining our youth, yada, 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 drug abuse, people diving off cliffs. Actually, that was LSD, the latest drug scare in the Santa Cruz Sentinel a day or two ago. But it is a real issue for some people, and one that has to, be directly addressed, and which Ian and John are not addressing, don't want to address, and probably won't address. Maybe they feel it's nobody's business how much money they make. Some people in private businesses feel that way. But in this kind of circumstance where there is such a, a need to know what's going on with the cannabis industry and importance of showing its reliability and its authenticity, I think these are legitimate questions. So let's hear some more. Again, these are interviews I did on Earth Day as I walked about in San Lorenzo benchlands talking to folks.
I mean, I want cheap meds, you know. If I want to get them, I want to go out and get them cheap, and I want it to be good. I want it to be yummy and fruity and smelly and affect me in a way that benefits me where I'm hurting.
Is this partially because of the competition, too? I mean, you have a number of other organizations that are also doing this.
We don't even know what the competition's doing. We're doing our own thing, man. We're taking all of our information from the public. Any changes that happen in the shop are directly from people like you and me who come into the shop and they look at what's going on and they say, hey, you guys could be doing this. And we're like, done.
Now, elsewhere in California, as you probably know, there's really an attack on medical marijuana. They're banning dispensaries. They're moratorium. They're ending dispensaries. In Santa Cruz City, they've limited dispensaries to two. To me, this is a form of kind of paranoid reefer madness, which is being done without any real justification. They can't find a crime problem around dispensaries. They can't find a health problem. So they create statistics that aren't really accurate. Like Mayor Coonerty has claimed that Santa Cruz only needs two dispensaries for its 57,000 people, which I think is, he doesn't apply such stats to bars or to pharmacies, as we mentioned before.
Yeah, of course.
So wouldn't it be, isn't there a concern you might have that other organizations such as yours will also, well, you're facing a common potential threat, even though Santa Cruz has a liberal, I think, falsely deserved reputation for this, because I've been following the medical marijuana thing for a long time. For 5 years, we had no dispensaries. Between 2000 and 2005, they stopped them from opening. And they're still. And the Measure K Commission has been hobbled by the city council, and that's supposed to make marijuana enforcement the lowest priority. So wouldn't it be wise to have a bunch of organizations together with some solidarity that are keeping an eye on what the authorities are doing as arrests for marijuana use increase?
In other words, you say you don't even know who the other dispensaries are. You don't pay any attention to what the other dispensaries do. My question was, in essence, isn't it a good idea to pay some attention, have some kind of common front against attacks on marijuana, whether it's from liberal bureaucrats claiming to be doing it for the good of the community or right-wing police agencies who want to simply eliminate and restore marijuana use and restore marijuana prohibition completely.
That's already in the process. We're part of a growing advocacy group, and it's names aren't, we're not able to mention any names yet, but it's a group that's...
I mean, why not? There are all kinds of agencies throughout the... there are at least 11 different groups that advertise for medical marijuana in the different Good Times and the Weekly and other you know publications and online. This combination of fluff and vagueness and secrecy and feel good rhetoric just you know doesn't impress me much.
That's gonna really be able to assist some of the collectives that are dealing with some of those difficulties right now, you know? I think it's a total bummer that we're still dealing with this stuff, you know? We've been fighting so hard, John especially. He pulled this off with so much resistance, and he just pushed and pushed. And that's the way it's going to happen. If we're going to survive in this industry and carve out our spot to help the community, which is crazy, we're having to carve out a spot to help people, but we're willing to do it because we really stand behind what we're doing.
So through this advocacy group, which you say has not quite gone public yet, perhaps
it's still forming.
You are in fact making connections with other groups because you were saying earlier that you're kind of an independent group. You're doing stuff on your own, pretty much. You haven't had a lot of connection with other groups, but in some sense, you are connecting.
Yeah.
Is there any concerns you want to bring to the community other than, of course, you know?
And I need to do in these interviews, and I think about it afterward, is. Well, then how are you connecting? And what groups are you connecting with? And how can people connect with you? Sort of solid questions to which I doubt they want to give solid answers, or which perhaps they could give solid answers. But we're not getting a lot of solid answers from these two, Ian and John. Lots of nice pavilion, nice-looking marijuana displays, I presume maybe even a great product, but still looking for the answers.
Suggesting people check out Creme de Cana. Is that the proper pronunciation? Anything you want to say about the issue generally and what's coming up? I know Americans for Safe Access. I guess there was recently, maybe it was a normal convention, looking for a new Proposition 19, the son of 19, that would decriminalize marijuana statewide in some way. Is there something you see coming up on the horizon there or locally that you're concerned about that you want to bring to people's attention here?
Yeah, it's going to come down to the public to be the activists. No bills. Nothing's going to happen unless they see numbers turn out with sincere voices and people willing to put their their beliefs on the line and willing to risk big and like John has had to do to start this thing. And like we're behind those people, man. We support those people. We give them what they need to get out there and go public.
And again, the problem is it's vague, all vague. There's nothing specific here. It's inspirational, you know, in general. We don't hear about his original fights one way or another. However, we have a phone call. We're going to interrupt this conversation to get the phone. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, this is Keith with Food Not Bombs.
Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs.
Yes, that is me.
And you are probably roosting in Colorado somewhere?
Well, I'm actually driving from Dallas, Texas to Fort Collins, Colorado by way of New Mexico.
Perhaps you can give us your exact location so we can have the police pick you up for talking on the cell phone.
Well, fortunately, in this state, you can probably do whatever you dang well please, because this is Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, where the wind goes sweeping down the plain.
Yeah, but they did vote against Sharia law here, and there are 2,000 Muslims in the state, but Sharia law is illegal here, so we're very confident that we're safe. So.
Well, that's good. I think they might want to bring in a Torquemada or possibly some other Grand Inquisitor to make sure that everyone has the proper religious beliefs.
Yeah, well, I do believe that we all are fundamentalist Christian here, we're supposed to be.
And Sharia law, for those who don't know, is a bunch of fundamentalist nonsense that Islamic fundamentalists follow, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. The people that voted that made the law against that are basically just as fundamentalists, but they are fundamentalists and have their own Sharia law, which is, and that's why they don't like the other Sharia law. But Sharia law, yeah, is like kind of like some kind of very old, kind of patriarchal Islamic law that's in some places like Iran and parts of Afghanistan and places like that might have.
Well, thou shalt not suffer an adulteress to live, I would suppose.
Yeah, and you can't walk, a woman can't walk with a man in public and things you know, normal stuff like that.
Uh-huh. Sounds exciting. Well, you know, there are, we have, of course, jurisdictions in this country which are attempting to elevate the whole situation food-wise, which Food Not Bombs, is, as I, most our listeners probably already know, is an organization concerned with the message, the political message, food, not bombs, pretty much.
Yeah, that's the basic idea was when we first started this, which was in 1980 in Cambridge and Boston, we had realized, well, Ronald Reagan had just been elected, and we were had this idea that since the United States at that time was spending 50 cents of every federal tax dollar on the military, that we could make this point that maybe if money were spent on things like food and education, health care, things like that, instead of on the military, that actually we would be a more secure country.
And how much, and is, so we, how much is being spent now, 31 years later?
It seems to be, according to the War Resisters League, which puts out this amazing pie chart, and also the Friends, the Friends has a legislative organization who does research also. They're saying it's like over, it's in the area now of about 65 cents of every federal tax dollar, between 60 and 65 cents.
So you've failed.
You
have Food Not Bombs.
After this 30 years of struggle, unfortunately.
Well, Keith McHenry, you have failed. You have failed to, you know, to turn this around. Why haven't you picked up something, some other job, like possibly, I don't know, government work overseas or...
Yeah, something like that. Well, the other crazy thing, of course, is that people do point out is that not only have you got that much money going towards the military out of the federal budget, and there's all Obama did actually apparently at some point in the last couple of days mention that he was going to freeze the military spending, which would actually be a huge thing, even though that's it's kind of not that impressive, but it's certainly different than any other president in a long time since Eisenhower, basically, who mentioned that this was a problem in the closing of his administration. But
I'm not as optimistic about this as you are. If you look at Obama's specifics, it actually involves increasing the military budget, not freezing
well,
it.
Well, that is actually, I'm sure, is it's great that he mentioned that it, something should happen. But, yeah, the likelihood of it actually happening and is completely unlikely in a positive
since,
way.
Particularly since he's continuing to escalate in Afghanistan. You know, there's no now we're getting talk about even the, you know, the 50,000 troops and I don't know how many tens or thousands of military contractors in Iraq will be staying on. Or, you know, we'll have to see what happens as the insurgency deepens and broadens over there.
It looks like they're going to send troops into Libya, too, if, you know, they're sending now what euphemistically is called advisors. We heard that at the beginning of the Vietnam War, right?
Kennedy sent advisors into South Vietnam, that's right. But, you know, what about the situation over in Orlando with, I understand finally the courts have ruled that your ilk isn't wanted except perhaps twice a year in the parks.
Yeah, this is a crazy thing. We, back in 2007, one of our volunteers was arrested for feeding more than 24 people in a park in violation of a new law that Orlando had passed where they created a downtown parks district, which includes also City Hall, the plaza in front of City Hall of Orlando. And these 42 parks... are part of this regulation where you have to apply for a permit to feed more than 24 people, and you're only allowed to share food and literature twice a year per park. So you'd have to move around. You could only do 84 times in city parks during the whole 12 months. Now there's one of the strategies, and so the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against us. Ken ruled against us and one abstained. And that's the 11th Circuit Court of Appeal in Atlanta. And immediately after that, the Tampa papers, for instance, announced that St. Petersburg, Florida, is considering enacting similar law to curb the activities of groups like Funa Bombs, which are basically Funa Bombs. And one of the issues, a lot of people mistake Funa Bombs for being a charity. And while it is true we feed lots and lots of people, the basic goal is to turn society around so no one has to depend on soup kitchens to eat. And with a huge amount of money being wasted on things like the military, you know, and the one thing to consider in that, too, is that the United States spends half the money that is spent on military preparations, so that, and then you, if you take the other half that is spent, countries like Britain and France, you know, supposedly allies, are spending the other half, you know. So,
Keith, explain that again. What do you mean they're spending the other half?
Okay, so you know, the United States spends half of the world's military budget. The United States government is spending half the money that is spent by the entire world on defense, so-called. So the other half that is not spent by the United States is spent by countries like England and Italy, Saudi Arabia, you know, France, and our allies.
Wouldn't you include, wouldn't you include Russia, India, and China, and Pakistan in those?
Yeah, Russia, Pakistan, right. All the other people in the world, Brazil. So what we're talking about is that, you know, the likelihood of England or going to war against the United States, you know, is getting more and more remote per century. So, you know, they've got tried subs, and in fact, they just had a crazy case where two Brits shot at each other in a Trident sub, and one was killed, you know, a nuclear-armed Trident sub. So the reality is the enemy, you know, which is, you know, the big enemy, I guess, would be China, which actually we pay to manufacture components for our weapons, and, you know, and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, you know, and, you know, that's who we're, like, aren't spending these billions of dollars to fight against. And so, you know, we could take some of that money. So we're trying to say that in the most visible way possible. And, you know, people have pointed out that if you go out onto the streets, and I've seen this myself in San Francisco, where you go to one of the meals at United Nations Plaza these days, and there's a person handing out, like, soup, and he's got, like, two buckets of soup and some bread, and he's struggling really hard, and he's giving people food. But when you ask the people there eating if they know the organization and what they're doing, they just think it's a church, and they're very grateful that they're eating. And that is certainly important. But, say, for instance, if you go out and you have a big banner and you have literature and you're just on a street corner saying that money should go to food, you know, saying food not bombs, well, people will come by, and that's interesting. They'll discuss stuff with you about that. But if you're actually making a direct impact by feeding people and you're seeing a banner saying food not bombs, and there's information talking about all kinds of different issues, the impact of the combined activity of feeding people visibly, lots of people, which you can do, and from food that's we actually recover from grocery stores and bakeries and stuff when they can't sell it, that coupled with a banner and literature gives a much, much deeper impact to the participant, to the witnesses of this event, that provides much stronger motivation to actually feel compelled to do something like even as small as call a congressperson or something, but at least start to engage in understanding that there are solutions to hunger and poverty in the United States if we just changed our priorities of our country. And so what the government is saying is that we don't have that right to do that, except for a couple of times, twice a year per park, and that we have to move around
now,
different park every week.
Has the city of Orlando, which we're talking about in Florida, and we're talking with Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs here, Has the city of Orlando demonstrated in its, you know, any specific conflict that Food Not Bombs is, I mean, taking up space that other organizations need or creating some unusual demand on park services, leaving behind mountains of trash, creating riots downtown? I mean, have they presented any evidence of this kind?
What they have said is that there are people that are not that don't have a lot of money that hang around in the city parks wherever Food Not Bombs is sharing food, and that this is a bad thing. That and that if Food Not Bombs stop handing out food and information down in these parks, then people wouldn't come around and eat and start talking to each other and hanging out, spending time there.
But surely that's not what the 11th en banc panel of the federal court said, the 11th Circuit Court. They didn't say
no,
that.
What they said was that a city, that our First Amendment rights were protected by this ordinance, since we are allowed to go with our literature and banners twice a year to each park, and hand out literature and under the banner Food Not Bombs and feed more than 24 people, that this is reasonable time, place, and restrictions on our free speech. That's what they're saying, that is that the city has that right because they control the parks, and if the city believes that our speech should be limited to twice a year per park, then our right to free speech is protected because we, in fact, can go out twice a year to each park and share food to more than 24 people with our literature and under the banner Food Not Bombs.
And devil's advocate, you could also go out every day, 24 hours a day, or as long as the parks are open, provided you did not dare to offer bagels, rice, and salad, right?
That we might be able to go out with just a banner, right, and with and not a table, but we could go out with a banner and stand in the park and hand flyers to people about this issue.
Well,
we could do that.
Well, you know, that's what we said.
But the impact of that is diminished dramatically from the impact of the fact that when you see that people with very little money can feed hundreds of people, and you and the comment is being made that money could be diverted from the military towards human needs, that message is much more powerful than the message of just holding a banner and handing out flyers.
Now,
that's a much stronger message.
Now, this is the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals overturned earlier decisions that supported you, or supported Orlando, Florida, and the Food Not Bombs there. I take it you could appeal this to the Roberts Supreme Court if you want, right?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely. The funny thing is I think the attorneys for Orlando want to do that, which is kind of a funny thing because I can't imagine them being very open to this argument, but potentially they would be. That would be interesting. My personal feeling is that they will probably, sadly agree with the city of Orlando, and therefore making it an even greater threat to even larger numbers of Food Not Bombs chapters than is already the case with the current ruling. So, but it's a possibility that Jacqueline Dow, the attorney, who is quite smart and who had eloquently described exactly what I just described, that the message of, is handing out the food and showing that basic services can be provided by common people with little resources under the banner Food Not Bombs, is a much stronger message than either just handing out the food by itself or handing out the flyers. Now, we've had cases. The thing that's really crazy is across the United States, we've had a number of cases where, like, for instance, Prescott, Arizona, Flagstaff, Arizona, Denver, Colorado, actually I could go on and on. There's lots of cities where the police have come out and city officials have come out and said Lancaster, Pennsylvania, even stuff like that. They've come out and said, look, you can share food with the hungry. We don't mind that, but you just can't have literature and a banner. And that we, and you can't put up flyers around town announcing the meal and announcing that your group is called Food on Bombs. And so a lot of people, like recently I was in Boone, North Carolina, and the students there that were doing Food on Bombs, told me that the police had come and told them that, and so they took away their literature and their banner and were sharing food. And I'd like pointed out that there was this thing called the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and it's your right to have literature and a banner. And they were shocked. They thought that that had been overturned and didn't realize that the right to freedom of speech still was considered a part of the U.S. Constitution.
Well, what the real question, Keith, is, as it was in Santa Cruz in 1988 and San Francisco in 1988 through 1996 and even thereafter, what was the response of the community when the police department and the courts, because we didn't win in Santa Cruz in the courts, and we didn't win in San Francisco in the courts. We actually lost, but we won in the streets, as I remember. You want to kind of recap that and maybe apply it to 2011 and these other cities you've just mentioned?
Yeah, that turns out to be the whole thing, just as you said, is that by resisting and continuing to share free food in defiance of the police and court orders, you end up eventually the state has to stop harassing you, because the average person, and particularly, and this is growing, this is becoming more and more the case than even in the 80s when this was happening in the 90s in the Bay Area. You know, we suffered over 1,000 arrests probably total in San Francisco. And they, for a period there, when the former chief of police, Frank Jordan, became mayor, the violence against Food on Bombs volunteers was rather severe. And people were injured, and including myself and quite a number of people. And then people actually spent a great deal of time in jail, like yourself. And this, at first, the mainstream papers like the Chronicle and Examiner were supportive of the campaign against Food on Bombs, and other corporate media were. But eventually, the tide turned. It became so obviously egregious that, and I think that's the case even more so now, that the idea that a country is spending so many billions on the military and at the same time is spending money to try to keep people from expressing that point of view and to keep people from sharing free food with the hungry, when the governments are not providing these meals and the corporations are not feeding these people, and that is getting to be even worse. Now, you know, with a housing foreclosure crisis, military budget expanding, services for regular people are being cut dramatically, and, you know, what we saw in San Francisco and Santa Cruz in those periods of times, I think, is magnified dramatically now. And so my sense is, and actually a weird thing, I already had a speaking tour of Florida planned for May. And now it looks like on May 18th is when they're expecting to be arrested at Orlando City Hall. And other cities are expecting to be arrested, too, in Florida, like St. Petersburg and Fort Lauderdale and St. Augustine, and cities where they've been already had laws on the books but were waiting to see the outcome of the Orlando case. So there could be mass arrests of Food on Bombs volunteers all over the state of Florida, and it may extend into the other states that are under the jurisdiction of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeal, which I believe are Georgia, maybe South Carolina. I have to go and look and see, and then Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana. So that region could be seeing a clampdown. And it's quite fascinating, too, that we have this ruling now when both national conventions, political conventions, are in that 11th Circuit Court of Appeals jurisdiction. So we're already preparing Typically, once it's announced that there's going to be a Republican and Democratic national conventions, then usually Food Not Bombs starts to organize to prepare meals at the protests at those conventions. And that's then the FBI usually infiltrates the those two chapters and then starts a campaign of disruption. And then, as happened in the last national conventions, our volunteers are arrested and accused of acts of terrorism. So,
happened to those charges? Were people actually convicted of any so-called acts of terrorism or any even minor offenses?
Well, the crazy thing, and the what became called the RNCA, which were 8 Food Not Bombs volunteers, have been planning the food and helping organize housing for the Minneapolis convention. They were charged originally with violating the Minnesota Patriot Act, and the FBI raided the 3 Food Not Bombs cookhouses the day 24 hours before the convention was to start. And arrested probably about 30, 40 people in total, but in the end only charged 8 of the 8 core members of Food Not Bombs with the Patriot Act. And those cases went on and on and on until in October they started to peter out and people started having their charges dropped. And eventually one person, I believe, pled guilty to plotting to knock over newspaper racks. And that became the whole big giant crime. But, you know, they cost a lot of money. There was all kinds of crazy, the houses were impounded for a while. It turned out that we had a number of informants. We had a couple of people actually become roommates at the Food Not Bombs house that turned out to be paid informants. And there was 2 Ramsey County Sheriff's Department officials who pretended like they were Food Not Bombs volunteers. And really how they organized the frame up of the Food Not Bombs people was that they, the informants and the, undercover cops would joke about bombing the Republicans and bombing the police at the meetings to plan the food for the conference. And, they used the transcripts of the paid informants and of the agents claim that we discussed those things at our meetings. And then those transcripts were handed over to a judge that issued a warrant, and then they were that provided evidence for the urgent need to raid the houses right before the convention. And then as the things evolved, it became clear that the entire thing was fabricated by the FBI and Homeland Security, and that the local authorities, like the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department, had been provided apparently $50 million by the Republican National Committee to defend it, you know, to do a number of things of which this was one of the things it was supposed to do.
Let me ask you, Keith, is this, although we haven't had a national convention under Obama, there have been obviously protests that Food Not Bombs has been present at. Has there been a continuing crackdown against Food Not Bombs with a national involvement from FBI and other national police-type agencies?
Well, there's only 2 things that I can say definitively from a FBI national security point of view. Since Obama got into office, and one of them was I was driving from Montreal to Burlington, Vermont, and when I crossed the border, I was rushed by the border people, Border and Customs, at gunpoint. They rushed my van and pulled me out, and I had to walk. They took me at gunpoint to a room, made me sit with my back to the door for a while, and then they seized my vehicle and held and did something to it for an hour and then eventually released me. And then the only other thing is I did just get some papers from the FBI I've been doing Freedom of Information Act requests, and a kind of a step-up campaign, and partially because of the fact that a number of Food Not Bombs volunteers are in prison, and I'm trying to create, a detailed account of how they've ended up in prison being framed by the FBI. And I did get information that there was an informant in Richmond, Virginia, shooting up bombs since Obama's been elected, and that informant filed papers about food not bombs going to Quantico to provide food at a protest for Bradley Manning. So those are the only two things that I'm aware of, directly. But of course, it's only 2 years, and it's like, usually this stuff takes, in fact, sometimes decades to come out. And I think the national conventions are typically our worst clampdowns that happen around them, and they've been escalating per time. So we had really bad trouble, with food not bombs being harassed in Los Angeles when the Democratic Convention was down there. It wasn't nearly as severe as it got to be when the New York City Convention and the Boston one, where we have a whole host of documents showing that there was an effort to keep the food not bombs gathering from happening, they were successful at. They had infiltrated both the Richmond food not bombs, which are the people that initiated the gathering in New York City, and the New York City chapter, and they questioned food not bombs volunteers at the food not bombs groups that were supposed to go join me in the food not bombs bus from Tucson to New York City. And so none of the volunteers, like in Denver, they were questioned by the FBI. The Lawrence, Kansas chapter was questioned, Kansas City, and so on. And so none of the volunteers actually ended up going with us.
Okay, so let me ask you, Kweiss, how many Food Not Bombs volunteers are currently in jail in the United States for feeding people with a political message?
Okay, there's nobody in jail for that crime. The people that are in jail now have been framed on terrorism charges. So the person that most concerns me, that I have the most direct relationship with, has been Eric McDavid. So Daniel McGowan was Food Not Bombs person. You have some of the Shaq 7 people are Food Not Bombs. I think almost all of them. Andrew, who is very Food Not Bombs, he just was released after 3 years. That would be the people trying to fight against the Huntington Animal Labs and the whole vivisection thing that was that. And then you have a number of the Operation Backfire, the people who were Food Not Bombs volunteers that were framed by arsons done by a guy named Ferguson out of Eugene. And the Eric McDavid case is like a very shocking case. So Eric McDavid and his two co-defendants, Zachary and Wren, helped them organize a food not bombs gathering in Philadelphia in 2005 after the 2004 gathering failed. And we had already had a suspicion that it failed because of infiltration, but we didn't get the documentation until sometime afterwards. But so we organized this gathering, and it was not very well attended as a result of us trying to clandestinely organize a public gathering. So we're trying to be like sort of advertising it, but not doing it so much that we would like try to attract too much attention to maybe make it so the government wouldn't take too much interest in this gathering. So anyway, the gathering did happen with about 250 people showing up for 2 days in Philadelphia, and then there was a protest against genetically modified foods and stuff was at a conference that was there. Well, after that, Eric and Zachary and Wren went with their friend Anna to California to Dutch Flats to stay at her father's house, driving in her father's car. When they got there, Anna had claimed to be in love with Eric and was pursuing him, and she happened to get a bunch of blasting caps and a book on how to make a bomb and urged Eric and Zachary and Wren to bomb a dam on the Sacramento River to save the fish. The Food Not Bombs kids refused to do that, and eventually the Homeland Security and the FBI got frustrated, and they raided the house. It turned out the FBI provided them with that house, and the car was not really the dad's car. It was an FBI that provided the car. And they arrested the three Food Not Bombs activists and charged them with plotting to bomb the dam and and they claimed that they were afraid that their agent Anna would be exposed, and that they might kill her or something like that. It was this whole crazy story. So then they went to they pitted the three co-defendants against each other. Eventually, Wren and Zachary agreed to sign a statement that Eric was the ringleader. When they went to trial, the jury actually, and you can see this on supporteric.org, they were very upset. They did not go with the idea of jury nullification, and they just ended up knowing, and they publicly said they knew Eric had really done nothing, that this was all organized by the FBI. But because of the plea bargain agreement, they agreed to convict Eric, and Eric got 20 years in prison. So that is one of the shocking cases that I'm trying to work on.
Grim, you know, getting back to the way that activists dealt with these issues in Arcata, in San Francisco, in Berkeley, and in Santa Cruz in the 90s, which is essentially when people were arrested, they just came back and served some more food. How do you think people in Orlando and other Florida cities and elsewhere are going to be addressing this issue? Is there the same level of activism as there was in the 90s? I know if we were in the Middle East, it would be a little different, perhaps, but we're in the United States. So I see less activism now than ever, and I'm wondering what you're seeing as you travel around from city to city trying to, you know, to stir it up.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I think that there is a definitely, there's attempts at activism everywhere. I mean, the understanding of the principles of free speech and what our rights are has been undermined really dramatically through the government and the corporations over the years. So there is sort of a basically lack of understanding and a lack of of how important your First Amendment freedom of speech rights are. But saying that, so this is the strategy that Orlando has, is one, I'm not 100% in agreement with this strategy, but, you know, it's their strategy, and it could be interesting. So what they're doing is they've asked labor unions and all these church groups and all these groups to each apply for their regular schedule. So they do, like, three times a week in Orlando. So they're going to have, they have a breakfast they do every Monday. So they're going to have church groups and stuff apply for, you know, so that there's, like, it's every Monday, it's still happening, but it's like, you know, what church group does two Mondays, and then a union does two Mondays, and so on. And then they're going to have, like, the same idea for the Wednesdays. So they're trying to get people to apply for permits, for two permits per year, for as many of the meals out to the future as possible. But at the same time, they're somewhat skeptical that they think that will make a political point, much like when we did we went through this whole health department thing in San Francisco to show it was a charade, and sure enough, in the end it was, and, they revoked the permit, and, shortly after they gave it to us, because in the end, they basically didn't, that wasn't the point. The point was to keep us from doing it, right? It wasn't the permits. And we ultimately applied 136 times for permits in San Francisco. Every time Frank Jordan told the media that all they have to do is apply for a permit, we would apply for a permit. We never got a response to any of our requests for permits in any of the 136 requests for permits. They never even wrote us a letter saying they weren't going to give us a permit. They pretended like they never received the application for a permit, basically. So,
well, as I remember, in 1991, there was a decision that, they had to provide, they had to allow a process, and they had to allow you access to the process, and then simply remove the whole process in San Francisco. And then we tried to get you into court to testify about that. They arrested you the first day of the court proceeding, and they released you the day that I was convicted. I mean, it was
correct. Yeah, that's what they did.
So, I
believe that'll be the case in Orlando. Basically, these people will make all these applications because that's not, another trick which people have mentioned repeatedly in the Orlando case is this divide up into groups of 24. Well, we did that in San Francisco as well. During the 1988 arrest, we set out on the in little groups of 24 with little cups that said 1 through 24 on them, on blankets, and we spread ourselves out throughout the entrance of the front area of Albert Lake at Golden Gate Park, and they arrested us anyway. They didn't care whether it was 24 people. You know, that's not, they don't care. The letter of the law is not significant to these people, to the authorities. So the reality is, I believe, on the 18th of May, they're going to arrest anybody that serves more than 24 people. And I really hope that they do that. One of the purposes of me going there is to encourage them to stand strong. You know, I would not even bother with this whole applying for, you know, having every community group apply for permits. But on another hand, it's not so bad, because what it does is it builds solidarity. So when they do start to arrest us, because they probably will, then all these other groups that have applied for permits who are also going to get arrested. It's sort of like what we did where we had risk arrest one day a month with Food Not Bombs, and church groups and unions and so on came out and shared food with San Francisco Food Not Bombs and got arrested. And if they have some personal investment in this by having applied for a permit that they then get, that gets rejected and then they get arrested.
I agree. Although I think the primary issue is the willingness to go beyond a legalistic attempt to follow the bureaucratic maze, which I think is designed specifically to frustrate, you know, those who want to do this. They don't want, as you said, visible poverty being shown, you know, in these areas that they're trying to redevelop the cities and gentrify them. You still there? Oops, I think we may have lost you. Perhaps Keith will call back. We've been talking with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, who is on his way to Colorado, talking about, sounds like we lost him. Maybe he'll get back to us, or maybe not. We'll see. He's been on the air a number of times on Free Radio before on this show, and you can find out more about the Orlando Food Not Bombs situation by going to foodnotbombs.net and kind of poking around there. Lots of information, not just about the Orlando Food Not Bombs, but also about a situation happening in other countries, such as Belarus, where the Minsk police declared the distribution of food to the poor unsanctioned action. Let's see who this is. And now, who could this be?
Yeah, it's Keith. As soon as I crossed the Texas border, I got kicked off the line. That's funny.
Interesting. So apparently it's hostile territory there in Texas, eh?
Yeah, it's so funny. It's like it said, welcome to Texas, and then you disappeared. That was funny.
Interesting. So, well, anyway. I'll talk with a Texas accent. How's that?
That's very good.
Does that sound better?
Where our wonderful rulers have come from, like George Bush and LBJ.
Yeah, well, they have quite a tradition in Texas. But, you know, I want to ask you, what do I want to ask you? Where is Food Not Bombs successful in raising issues like you and others were trying to raise issues in San Francisco in the late 80s and early 90s, for example, with respect to politicians like Agnos and Jordan and then Brown on their treatment of the homeless, because that became an issue where, in essence, you were allowing larger groups of homeless people to converge in a regular way, in some cases set up tents and tent cities, which is happening now more and more throughout the country as foreclosure economic crisis deepens.
Well, you know, there is some effort at that, and I know San Francisco Food Not Bombs, for instance, had just done this thing where they shared free food in front of Macy's in protest to a sit-lie law that was passed in San Francisco and blockaded the doors of these department stores. So that was definitely the kind of thing that they've been doing, and then they've been doing New Homes Not Jails actions. So there is this resurgence in the San Francisco Food Not Bombs movement to do that. I know we were really damaged politically by what I believe was infiltration, and some of it is provable and some is just like, I can't quite tell what's going on. But there became this depoliticization of Food Not Bombs in key cities like San Francisco, New York City, Washington, D.C., where the banner and the literature was removed and the became a charity, essentially, and then participation in feeding these kinds of actions that, kind of just stopped happening. But that was in the in basically cities that I, my sense, the reason I think it's planned is because, one, I've read some documents to the fact that that is true, that I've gotten in Freedom of Information Act requests. But also, you know, they're just, I've noticed that the pattern gets reproduced because people think that, of course, you know, the nation's capital, that Blue Note Bombs must be one of the most important ones. And then people see it and they reproduce that idea. And I know for definitely that that's true with San Francisco, that I've had lots of comments about that over the years. So this is a renewed thing to try to encourage chapters to resist. And the strange thing is that the, you know, smaller cities, the Blue Note Bombs groups do resist and do participate in these kind of actions. And Long Island Blue Note Bombs chapters have been doing such, you know, really well. Miami Blue Note Bombs, before it was collapsed, but it's now springing back up again, they did a fed an action of people taking over the land, homeless people, tent city, where they seized public land and started camping out, and Blue Note Bombs provided food to that action. And that was very similar to the tent city action in 89 in San Francisco. This would have been about 3 years ago in Miami. So there are cases in the United States where that is happening, for sure, to address local anti-homeless laws. Tempe, Arizona, Blue Note Bombs people did a bunch of work around anti-sitting laws in Tempe and Mesa. So this definitely is happening, and my hope is to encourage this to happen even more, because partially I think what's happened is that the story of what went on in San Francisco at the Tent City protest and at other similar actions during that in late 80s, early 90s, was erased basically from the activist history, and people are unaware that there's these very strong actions that could happen where Blue Note Bombs could be in solidarity with homeless people doing these really militant direct actions like the Tent City protest.
And so your next book will be about that particular period, will it not, Keith?
Well, I do have one book that's coming out shortly that'll have a little bit of the history and of that kind of stuff, but very briefly, but mostly strategy on how to how to do Blue Note Bombs and be and have it influence, you know, be used as a direct action strategy as opposed to a charity. And that's like, I'm harping on that endlessly. I'm trying to remind people that that is definitely true. And then I have a book following that, which will detail the history of Blue Note Bombs and these kinds of actions, including the, you know, Blue Note Bombs shared food at a number of tent city protests in other countries. For instance, they fed people for 100 days in the Ukraine in what became the Orange Revolution. And they also fed people for 600 days in Bosnia-Herzegovina Park in Sarajevo. The Blue Note Bombs fed a two-month action on the West Bank. They've done, you know, like, they've been doing, like, these kind of occupations like this. I don't know if they were involved in the Cairo action, you know. I know they're doing stuff in Jordan. My Arabic translator has disappeared. He's from Libya. He was in Libya, and hopefully still is, or at least alive. And so they're, you know, so these, you know, outside the United States has been really successful Blue Note Bombs meeting of long-term tent city protests and actions for Aboriginal people in Australia and things like that. So it's been really pretty amazing. And I really hope that, you know, that this will be the case in the United States. I hope that, you know, like, say, the new Santa Cruz Blue Note Bombs could potentially provide food at occupations and tent city actions, not only to support the rights of people living on the streets of Santa Cruz County, but also to defend the right to education and things like that. I mean, we should be having an uprising basically all around the United States because the forces that are attacking homeless people in the United States are doing so for the same reasons as why they're cutting, you know, education budgets and why they're gutting health care and why they're gutting everything, basically.
Well, I know there were some, you know, sort of echoes of Tunisia and Egypt and Bahrain and Yemen in Wisconsin for a while there, but then it seemed to have murmured off into let's wait for the courts.
Yeah, see, this is the problem of the United States, where there's people are have forgotten that, like, the whole thing that happened, like, with people back in the 1700s was that they hung in there until they, you know, got rid of the king and everything like that. And they did things like civil disobedience actions, like throw tea in the harbor in Boston and stage, you know, mark protests outside the State House in Boston until they got shot at and stuff like that. You know, so we somehow got to energize the United States. And that, to me, that's so important that we start to take much stronger action. And see, the food not bombs has this unique situation that we're taught we have food and we can get food and we can provide food for long actions. And essentially, Tunisia and Yemen Egypt and these all Bahrain and all this are tent city protests, right? These people are going out to sit the plaza in front of their government buildings and just staying there for weeks and weeks at a time. And that simple act appears to freak out governments to overreact and to go crazy, and it seems to be like having a huge impact. The problem with all these things, while they seem to be overthrowing all these governments pretty, handily in some cases, and certainly causing huge level of public questioning about the authority of these dictators and so on, is that they're not really replacing them with any kind of thing successfully. And I think that's the other aspect of food not bombs, that if we were getting back into more, is that with the Tent City action, we used to have meetings where we used a process called consensus to make decisions, and we invite the residents of, you know, all the people living in the park would have try to come up with decisions that everybody got behind. And while it was very simplistic, the fact that it happened, and it happened with people who were in solidarity with one another over that particular effort of ending repression against people living in San Francisco on the streets, it was very empowering, and I still get contacted by people who were homeless and participated in those actions at that time. So that's something that I think food not bombs could really do. Like the Santa Cruz food not bombs could, in its weekly meetings, practice using consensus to make decisions with the goal of ultimately being a community that is egalitarian and democratic and empowered, so that in doing things like staging protests that topple governments and so on, that they already have a kind of a little system of communication and decision making that can start to be implemented at a larger level. And I've seen that happen in a number of really amazing cases, and the most amazing one that inspired me to do this for 31 years was Clamshell Alliance in New England, where we had the Clam Congress, and just about 6,000 people made decisions by consensus in affinity groups, and we had these amazing direct actions as a result. So I know that this kind of thing could really be transformative and really effective, and that was something we really practiced in the anti-nuclear movement all the way up until like the 1990, and we've sort of lost our path in we did that successfully in San Francisco, food not bombs, all the way through up till 97, but then that stopped happening, and I'd hate, you know, and I'd be disappointed to think it stopped happening just because I became started helping Leonard Peltier Defense Committee and left town. But does sort of coincide with that.
Well, what about Phutna bombs throughout the country? Are any Phutna bombs actually using this consensus process? Because I know it's regarded by many. We have a pseudo consensus process at Free Radio, for example, which is it's a consensus, but if one person is holding out, then the entire group can overrule them if they want. You know, I mean, it's not really consensus in that sense, but consensus.
That's a shame because, I mean, I think that you can actually. I mean, part of the idea is to keep making the proposal, altering it until all people really get behind it. And people, you know, need to have goodwill and only really block if it's, you know, fundamentally objectionable to the. You know, to the vision of whatever your project is.
And doesn't this really kind of this mitigate against the concerns you also have, which you've expressed in this discussion and also at other times when we've talked about infiltrators and agents? I mean, my response to people who say, "Hey, that's a government agent," in the many organizations I've been in, is say, "Oh well, put them to work. You know, who cares?" You can't make judgments as to what people who does what. Really, you just have to keep. Working around, you know, toward the same objectives. If you start worrying about, you know, who's an agent here and who's an agent there, then you get into a kind of a paranoid, divisive trip. But I mean,
that attitude is whether they are an agent or not. If that kind of thing gets to be the what everybody's discussing, then that's definitely more destructive. And then, you know, they don't even have to be an agent, and you've already got, like, everybody all freaked out, and no one's doing anything. So you're right, exactly. The thing is that you've got, like, your organization, like in the case of a radio station, you're trying to do radio. So you got to keep focused on doing radio and allowing people to express what they want to say on the radio and making sure it goes on air and all that. And even if you have infiltrators in it, as long as they're going on the air and maybe what their program is completely lame and stuff, well, you know, that's that. You know, as long as you don't, they're not successful at shutting the radio station down.
And not really talking about, I hear you. I'm not talking about radio. I'm talking about Food Not Bombs. Are any Food Not Bombs groups using this pure consensus process, which, you know, was the big thing in the 70s for a while, at least with the Clamshell Alliance, and then you continued through the 80s with a number of groups. Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs used it in the 90s when there was a Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs. And I don't think, you tell me there's a Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs now. I'm looking for it. You know, show me.
Well,
I want to find it.
They've been emailing me saying that they're starting up, and they emailed me a website that they just are putting up.
Email it back to me.
Just renewed in the last, like, 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, email it back to me. Email it to me. I'll pass it on. I'll try to get them on the air to talk about stuff. If they may be on already. They may have talked in other programs. I may not have heard them, so I don't know.
But there are actually, I'm very impressed about the number of chapters that do actually use consensus. And take that seriously. That is really, really fantastic, actually. I think it could be more, but there is definitely a widespread, agreement, you know, there is an attempt. Now, I think what happens I think one of the trends I've been seeing in the last, like, you know, 5 or 6 years is chapters feeling pressure to have the meal. So they actually will cut the vegetables and everything while having their meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thought, that seems like a really logical and cool thing to do. But I've noticed in participating in meetings where that's what's happening, the focus is diminished quite dramatically. So I think that, you know, it's kind of hard to cut vegetables and all that and really be focused on making decisions. So I'm actually encouraging chapters to really have a weekly meeting and bring people in to that meeting because it provides access to, you know, newcomers.
I think
that's really important, and it makes the decision-making much more clear.
Well, what about knitting? Are people allowed to knit during the meetings?
Well, maybe, a little bit. But the problem when you're actually cooking is that you get distracted, you know, and you all of a sudden you're having a discussion about who is burning what and things like that. I've noticed it just wasn't as focused, and I do because I recall and I was just talking to a woman, Violet, who was in the main, you know, helped us during that whole heavy part of the arrest in San Francisco Phutna Bombs, and she was talking about the meetings and how. really terrific, inspiring they were. And we just met. You know, we went to Epicenter Zone in Valencia Street, and we sat there and a group of sometimes as many as, like, 40 people. And we had go-arounds, and we had, like, used the consensus process. We described the process at the beginning, what the philosophy of it was briefly, and we did a ton of stuff besides sharing food twice a day at, you know, Civic Center Plaza and getting arrested and beaten and jailed and having court cases. We also took food to all kinds of other actions, and, you know, it was really amazing. And so, you know, I had kind of an unfortunate argument with San Francisco Food Nonprofits because I suggested that they have a weekly meeting, and they were really upset about that, didn't want to have that. And I'm like, well, look at all these new volunteers that are calling because of doing the book, Anarchist Book Fair and things like that. And the way they were doing it was informal. You showed up to the one cookhouse on Thursday, and one of the people would greet you and welcome you there, and he was a really friendly guy. But you wouldn't know how to plug in to the larger thing. I myself, having been in Food Nonprofits for 31 years, I couldn't figure out how to plug in. So if I was having a hard time figuring out what was going on, and I had an idea of what was supposed to be going on, I thought, I can imagine a person who's never been to a Food Nonprofits meal.
I don't think.
Have no idea.
I hear you, and I don't think Santa Cruz has actually had regular meetings for over a decade. I mean, they've served some food, and Food Nonprofits has come to political actions, and indeed was at the center of the drum circle struggle, which maintained the public space for that event for another year and a half until it was seized by the merchants. But, you know, it's a problem. Let me shift now, because I only have about 11 minutes left. I'm talking with Keith McHenry, a co-founder of Food Nonprofits. You remember Tony Mello?
Yeah, I remember Tony. And the last I tried to meet up with him in Oaxaca, but I never could connect with him.
You know what happened with Tony?
No, I never knew what happened.
Tony was murdered last week in Oaxaca. And for those who remember him, you can go online. Just go look for Tony, spelled T-O-N-E-E, Mello, M-E-L-L-O. And you can read, there was a ceremony for him yesterday in Fresno where he spent a lot of time before he went down to Mexico. Mike Rhodes of the Community Alliance did some work with him. And, of course, he spent a lot of time here in Santa Cruz organizing Homes Not Jails and Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs. And
what happened to him? I mean, was he killed in a political murder?
I'm not sure because my knowledge of Spanish is limited. But from what I understand, it was a robbery, and his body was found, you know, near the house in bad shape. And I guess I'll read a little bit from the Indy Bay article that, you know, that discusses this, but it's not terribly enlightening. It's just, you know,
Tony Mello killed.
Yeah.
Well, we had a number of, I mean, I was down there about it. Two Decembers ago, and I was working with the people that had been doing Food Not Bombs and were doing Food Not Bombs. And two of the people that I met with, there was a group called Cactus, which was did a lot of things like garden, you know, organic gardening and all kinds of support work for indigenous people in Oaxaca. And they, one of their projects was Food Not Bombs, and the two core people of that were murdered, couple of months after I had left, and that was a political murder for sure there. And so that has been happening to organizers. And another Food Nonprofits woman was from San Francisco Food Nonprofits was raped and killed in Oaxaca about 3 years ago, and that turned out to be also a political murder in Oaxaca. So these things happen.
Here's what the online story from Indy Bay from April 15th. Tony Mello, one of the 2005 co-founders of the Oaxaca Study Action Group, as well as I'm sure many groups throughout California and Mexico, or at least certainly throughout California, at least in Fresno and Santa Cruz, was murdered at his home in Oaxaca on Monday, April 11th. His body was discovered on Thursday, April 14th, in a well on his own property. Among Tony's belongings, his car, motorcycle, and computer were taken. The wall safe had been ripped loose but not opened. The house was not otherwise ransacked. Police investigations are now underway. Tony was widely known and admired among both the United States and Mexican communities for his generosity and willingness to assist those who needed help. It was a bad loss. And then there's a lot in Spanish on this thread, which I can't really accurately translate. Tony's son, John, this is written by Mike Rhodes, is in Oaxaca. He was overwhelmed in dealing with his father's death with all the attendant details, and there was a memorial, as I said yesterday. I added something that he started a Food Not Bombs and Homes Not Jails chapter, as I mentioned before, in the summer of 1992 here in Santa Cruz. Worked here for several years, raising homeless activism to a new level in organization and spirit. He fought police misconduct and organized a street education campaign against Officer Lauren Butchie Baker's sexual abuse against 10 women, the homeless population, and political activists. He fought for the civil rights of homeless people, involved in organizing protests by Homes Not Jails and standing up against physical violence and personal police harassment. He fought city council indifference, leading an effort to occupy the offices of the city council and city manager in 1992. He helped with early organizing for free radio. He stood up against and spoke out against discrimination at homeless services such as the St. Francis Soup Kitchen. And then I have a very brief bit of his voice, which I've also put online, and just sort of a...
Wow, that's really hardcore. That's so sad. Wow.
Yeah, it is.
What
it
a is. Trip. Yeah, he also, of course, another thing that was really amazing is that he, out of his own pocket, paid for many young people and helped, you know, them as a surrogate father. And that was also really miraculous that, you know, he was the unofficial foster parent for quite a number of people, and if I recall correctly, that's really tragic. Wow.
And I think he would say, of course, you know, what Joe Hill said, you know, don't mourn.
Yeah.
Don't mourn, organize, but, you know, maybe you can do both. I don't know.
Yeah, the other thing that was, you know, in regards to Mexico is Tony... there was a group in Spain that translated the Funabon's book into Spanish, and I was able to give him like a lot of copies of that, and he drove all over Mexico with that, with those books, giving them out, trying to start chapters. He had a little VW van that he lived in, a camper, and before he settled in Oaxaca, he traveled all over the country giving out copies of this book in Spanish and trying to encourage people to start Food Not Bombs. And now there are chapters all over Mexico, and many of them probably as a result of his work. So.
Yeah, and he distributed free radio down there too, radio
yeah.
transmitters and such. He was, you know, he was an active, he was a communist who believed in radical change and redistribution of the wealth, and he was he was outspoken in that regard. And,
and he was also very involved in the teachers' uprising in Oaxaca. That's the thing that most activists are, you know of, and where Brad Will was killed, and you know, so that's. One of the other things. That
yeah, you know, if you can, go online. I encourage other people who know Tony to go online to, it's, you can find it by, rather than giving a long address, if you Google for Tony Mello, and I put dead in front of it, that sounds a little crass, but that's how I find it, D-E-A-D, dead, and then Tony, but again, T-O-N-E-E, and then Mello, M-E-L-L-O, you'll find the Indie Bay story, which has a lot of discussion in Spanish, and I've got a little in English, and so does Mike Rose, and you might want to post something too, Keith, as a memory. Of
oh, yeah, for sure, and yeah. I'll put it on the Food Not Bombs website. Wow, that's really intense.
I appreciate you taking the time. I'm out of it. I got 3 minutes till I got to leave the studio, and the next show comes in, but...
Well, everybody, just as a final closing, is foodnotbombs.net. Is the website about Food Not Bombs, foodnotbombs.net, and that leads you to all the other chapters. If you go to foodnotbombs.net, and then go to all contacts on the front page, and then follow, go to the United States, and then go to California, and you go down, you'll see the new link to the new website for the new Santa Cruz Food Not Bomb chapter.
I'll go there and take a look.
And we definitely need tons of support there. I have been talking to a woman over in Monterey that's trying to do a Food Not Bombs over there, and I'm hoping that she's getting support. And so I think that the more militant Food Not Bombs can be, you know, within the basic concept of nonviolent direct action and doing things like feeding occupations and helping organize actions, that's really valuable. Also, people, if you can't go online, and you can call me toll-free at 1-800-884-1136. And that's the old Food Not Bombs hotline that still exists, 1-800-884-1136, and it's wherever I happen to be going. And I've been speaking at colleges, and I would love to speak at the University of Santa Cruz next year. This is always a big struggle to try to organize that for some reason, but it would be great if that happened.
We've been talking, Keith, about trying to kick down some money to get you to come and just speak at a rally for the next Tent City folks, because we're going to trial, not I, but a bunch of other people are going to trial on actually next Monday. And I'll be talking about that more on Sunday during my show. Maybe we should call you again and try to get you to come on again for a little update on what's happening, although you've kind of updated us a lot.
Yeah, you might want to wait until we start getting arrested in mid-May, and then we can call back in.
Okay.
So we can say how many people got arrested and what their charges are and all that.
And all the thrill of that, yes. Well, listen, thank
cool.
you.
Cool. Okay.
Oh, yeah. That's my
name. Rise up right away. We need to have a generalized rebellion here in North America as soon as humanly possible.
All right. Well,
you've
issued the call.
What I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Hey, thank you, Keith. Bye-bye.
Whoa.
And that was Keith McHenry from En Route to Colorado, on the road, but apparently speaking nonetheless. So I'll be back on Sunday with more, probably, unless I hit the road, as I probably should, and who knows. That's going to be usually at 9:30 in the morning. Sometimes I come in earlier because Thomas Lovett has not been waking us up with a wake-up call. He's been staying asleep. Because
sleep in call?
It's more of a sleepy call because apparently the people who are supposed to be getting the DSL line in so that we can actually go live have not been doing so. I've thought of possibly conducting some kind of inquisition to find out who is behind the sabotaging of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Actually, Dennis here is... He will be handling the next show.
5 to 10 business days.
Got another one of his lengthy, tiresome predictions, which so far have not been, shall we say...
I cannot say that they have been altogether accurate up to this point.
But you've been trying. That's the point. There you are.
I've been very trying.
Yeah. Yes. No. Actually, you haven't. You've been working very hard on this issue, is my impression, though I haven't been with you at your side all the time, thank God. But, in fact, you know, I know you're really putting in a lot of energy getting into this. And I'm going to let you take over because it's that time of the evening. It's a time for from the cream to the dregs. My time is past. I'm a has-been on this particular evening. So thank you for listening. If you want to catch me off air, you can. 423-HUFF, which is the HUFF line, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, 423-4833. Trial begins next Monday in Department 2 for the Peace Camp 6. And I'll be talking more about that on Sunday. More information soon on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. Dennis, grab yourself a disc, and you'll be able to, should we say, slide gently into the next segment.
I'm just going to do this for a minute. Just a little basic update for people who want to know what's going on. The phone line to our transmitter has had some problems, and
say the least.
Well, the good news is that I have been told I have no facts, but I have been told there are unconfirmed rumors that the phone line will be installed tomorrow. And that 5 to 10 working days after that, we will have DSL. Now, as I said, this is an unconfirmed rumor. We will see if there's any further action on this. But we are totally at the mercy of a unfriendly multinational corporation who does not have our best interest in mind and, needless to say, probably doesn't even know we exist.